Having made up my mind to go, I set about making the necessary preparations. First, I got the deed from Sir Henry providing for my boy in case of accidents. Then I set about procuring the necessary items for our long journey. First, the question of provisioning and medicines, one which required the most careful consideration, for what one had to do was to avoid any excess, and yet take everything absolutely necessary. Fortunately, it turned out that Good was a bit of a doctor, having at some period in his previous career managed to pass through a course of medical and surgical instruction. He arranged for a splendid traveling medicine chest and a few medical instruments. Next, I put together an ample supply of various weapons, making sure that those of each class were the same make and caliber, so the cartridges would be interchangeable. Now, as to the men who were to go with us. After much consultation, we decided that their number should be limited to 2 servants. It was necessary that they should be thoroughly trustworthy and brave men, as in a business of this sort, our lives might depend upon their conduct. At last, I secured one, a Hottentot called Ventvogel, or Windbird. Having got this man, I looked in vain for a second to suit my purpose. So we determined to start without one, trusting to luck to find a suitable man on our way up country. But on the evening before the day we had fixed for our departure, I was informed that a man was waiting to see me. Accordingly, when we had done dinner, for we were at table at the time, I told him to bring him in. Presently, a very tall, handsome-looking man, somewhere about 30 years of age, and very light-colored for a Zulu, entered, and lifting his knobstick by way of salute, squatted himself down in the corner on his haunches and sat silent. I didn't take any notice of him for a while, for it's a great mistake to do so. If you rush into conversation at once, a Zulu is apt to think you a person of little dignity or consideration. "Well," I said at last, "what's your name?"
"Umbopa,"
answered the man in a slow, deep voice. "What is it you want?"
"It is this, Kumazan."
"That is my Kaffir name, and means the man who gets up in the middle of the night, or in vulgar English, he who keeps his eyes open."
"I hear that you go on a great expedition far into the north with the white chiefs from over the water. Is it a true word?"
"It is."
"I hear that you go even to the Lukanga River, a moon's journey beyond the Manika country. Is this so also, Macumazahn?"
"Why do you ask whither we go? What is it to thee?" I answered, suspiciously, for the objects of our journey had been kept a dead secret.
"It is this, O white men, that if indeed you travel so far, I would travel with you. I am of the Zulu people, yet not of them. The house of my tribe is in the far north. It was left behind when the Zulus came down here 1,000 years ago, long before Chaka reigned in Zululand. I have wandered for many years. Now I am tired and would go north again. I want no money, but I am a brave man, and am worth my place and meat. I have spoken."
Sir Henry walked up to him and looked into his proud, handsome face.
"I like your looks, Mr. Umbopa, and I will take you as my servant."
Umbopa evidently understood him, for he answered in Zulu,
"It is well."
And then, with a glance at the white man's great stature and breadth,
"We are men, you and I."
With great difficulty and by the promise of a present of a good hunting knife each, I succeeded in persuading 3 wretched natives from the village to come with us for the first stage, 20 miles, and to carry each a large gourd holding a gallon of water. My object was to enable us to refill our water bottles after the first night's march, for we determined to start in the cool of the night. I gave out to these natives that we were going to shoot ostriches, with which the desert abounded. They jabbered and shrugged their shoulders, and said we were mad and should perish of thirst, which I must say seemed very probable. But being desirous of obtaining the knives, which were almost unknown treasures up there, they consented to come, having probably reflected that, after all, our subsequent extinction would be no affair of theirs. All next day we rested and slept, and at sunset ate a hearty meal of fresh beef washed down with tea, the last, as Good sadly remarked, we were likely to drink for many a long day. Then, having made our final preparations, we lay down and waited for the moon to rise. At last, about 9 o'clock, up she came in all her chastened glory, flooding the wild country with silver light, and throwing a weird sheen on the vast expanse of rolling desert before us, which looked as solemn and quiet and as alien to man as the star-studded firmament above. We rose up, and in a few minutes were ready, And yet we hesitated a little, as human nature is prone to hesitate on the threshold of an irrevocable step. We three white men stood there by ourselves, Umbopa, a segai in hand and a rifle across his shoulders, a few paces ahead of us, looked out fixedly across the desert. The three hired natives, with the gourds of water, and Van Vogel, were gathered in a little knot behind.
"Gentlemen," said Sir Henry presently in his low, deep voice, "we are going on about as strange a journey as men can make in this world. It is very doubtful if we can succeed in it. So now, before we start, let us for a moment pray to the power who shapes the destinies of men, and who ages since has marked out our paths, that it may please him to direct our steps in accordance with his will."
So we started. We had nothing to guide ourselves by except the distant mountains and old José da Silvestre's chart, which, considering that it was drawn by a dying and half-distraught man on a fragment of linen 3 centuries ago, was not a very satisfactory sort of thing to work on. Still, such as it was, our sole hope of success depended on it. If we failed in finding that pool of bad water, which the old Dom marked as being situated in the middle of the desert, about 60 miles from our starting point, and as far from the mountains, we must, in all probability, perish miserably of thirst. And to my mind, the chances of our finding it in that great sea of sand and karoo scrub seemed almost infinitesimal. Even supposing da Silvestre had marked it right, what was there to prevent its having been generations ago dried up by the sun, or trampled in by game, or filled with the drifting sand? On we tramped, silently as shades through the night and in the heavy sand. The karoo bushes caught our shins and retarded us, and the sand got into our shoes and goods shooting boots, so that every few miles we had to stop and empty them. But still, the night was fairly cool, though the atmosphere was thick and heavy, giving a sort of creamy feel to the air, and we made fair progress. On we went, till at last the east began to blush like the cheek of a girl. Then there came faint rays of primrose light that changed presently to golden bars, through which the dawn glided out across the desert. The stars grew pale and paler still, till at last they vanished. The golden moon waxed wan, and her mountain ridges stood out clear against her sickly face like the bones on the face of a dying man. Then came spear upon spear of glorious light, flashing far away across the boundless wilderness, piercing and firing the veils of mist, till the desert was draped in a tremulous golden glow, and it was day. Still we didn't halt, though by this time we should have been glad to do so, for we knew that when once the sun was fully up, it would be almost impossible for us to travel in it. At length, about an hour later, we spied a little pile of rocks rising out of the plain, and to this we dragged ourselves. Having drunk some water each and eaten a bit of dry meat, we lay down and were soon sound asleep. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon before we woke, to find our 3 bearers preparing to return. They had already had enough of the desert, and no number of knives would have tempted them to come a step farther. So we had a hearty drink, and having emptied our water bottles, filled them up again from the gourds they had brought with them, and then watched them depart on their 20 miles tramp home. At 4:30, we also started on. It was lonely and desolate work, for with the exception of a few ostriches, there wasn't a single living creature to be seen on all the vast expanse of sandy plain. It was evidently too dry for game, and with the exception of a deadly-looking cobra or two, we saw no reptiles. We went on this way for 2 more days, days filled with intense heat and growing thirst. On the 3rd day, and as soon as we were all well awake, we fell to discussing the situation, which was serious enough. Not a drop of water was left. We turned the water bottles upside down and licked the tops, but it was a failure. They were as dry as a bone. Good, who had charge of the bottle of brandy, got it out and looked at it longingly. But Sir Henry promptly took it away from him, for to drink raw spirit would only have been to precipitate the end.
"If we do not find water, we shall die."
"If we can trust to the old Dom's map, there should be some about," I said. But nobody seemed to derive much satisfaction from that remark. It was so evident that no great faith could be put in the map. It was now growing gradually light, and as we sat blankly staring at each other, I observed the Hottentot Van Vogel rise and begin to walk about with his eyes on the ground. Presently he stopped short, and uttering a guttural exclamation, pointed to the earth. "What is it?" we exclaimed, and simultaneously rose and went to where he was standing, pointing at the ground. "Well," I said, "it's pretty fresh springbok spore. What of it?"
"Springboks do not go far from water," he answered in Dutch.
"No, I forgot, and thank God for it. This little discovery put new life into us." Meanwhile, Van Vogel was lifting his snub nose and sniffing the hot air for all the world like an old impala ram who sensed danger. Presently, he spoke again.
"I smell water."
It was all very well for Van Vogel to say he smelt water, but look which way we would, we could see no signs of it. So far as the eye could reach, there was nothing but arid, sweltering sand and karoo scrub. We walked round the hillock and gazed about anxiously on the other side. But it was the same story. Not a drop of water was to be seen. There was no indication of a pan, a pool, or a spring.
"You are a fool," I said angrily to Van Vogel. "There is no water."
But still, he lifted his snub nose and sniffed.
"I smell it, boss. It is somewhere in the air."
"Yes, no doubt it's in the clouds, and about 2 months hence it will fall and wash our bones." Sir Henry stroked his yellow beard thoughtfully.
"Perhaps it is on the top of the hill."
"Rot," said Good. "Whoever heard of water being found on the top of a hill?" "Let's go and look," I put in, and hopelessly enough, scrambled up the sandy sides of the hillock, Umbopa leading. Presently he stopped as though he was petrified.
"Nazia Manzi!"
"Here is water," he cried with a loud voice. We rushed up to him, and there, sure enough, in a deep cup or indentation at the very top of the sand koppie, was an undoubted pool of water. How it came to be in such a strange place, we didn't stop to inquire, nor did we hesitate at its black and uninviting appearance. It was water, or a good imitation of it, and that was enough for us. We gave a bound and a rush, and in another second, we're all down on our stomachs, sucking up the uninviting fluid as though it were nectar fit for the gods. Heavens, how we did drink! Then when we had done drinking, we tore off our clothes and sat down in it, absorbing the moisture through our parched skins. After a while, we arose from it, refreshed, and ate our fill of dry meat. Then we smoked a pipe and lay down by the side of that blessed pool under the overhanging shadow of the bank, and slept till midday.